What a songwriter he is. Andrew Peterson, Holy is the Lord. And we heard from Hard Times, voice you haven't heard in probably a decade or three, Jamie Owens Collins. And When Night is Falling, that would have been Dennis Ward, along with some ample help from Matthew Ward and Annie Herring. It's 12 minutes after the hour on a Monday morning here along the Broken Road, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, our resident biochemist, the only biochemist we have on staff, by the way, and a member of the board at Creation Moments. And Don comes to us from Garden Valley, Texas, just east of Dallas. Just you can almost see Dallas from there. Well, it's so flat, you probably can, can't you?
Well, not quite. Actually, we have gentle rolling hills here.
Oh, in East Texas, gentle rolling so. Hills. Okay, I see.
Yeah, no, it's about 80, 90 miles from Dallas.
Well, Don lives in what is becoming rapidly the wine country of East Texas. I don't suppose that they can grow grapes out West Texas, can they?
Not far West Texas. It's probably too dry. I don't know about necessarily too hot, but
they have great dust out there. Yeah,
but north West Texas they do.
Okay,
I would. That's the big wine growing area, mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of wineries out there, but there's an awful lot of bigger wine vineyards.
Well, Don is starting his vineyard, and we delight in catching up on the latest of how the grapes are, and the vines, and the weather, and all that kind of thing. He's a man of the earth, he is, particularly the young earth. We talk about that a whole lot. Young earth and old earth, creation versus faith and evolution and all that sort of thing. And we have a huge topic to tackle this morning. In fact, I can see this taking several weeks, and it's based on an article that's over at creation.com. Now, not creationmoments.com. We talk about their website frequently. This is simply creation.com, and the article has to do with the biblical roots of science. And Don, you and I and David have long talked about this, but this is probably the most persuasive and articulate perspective on that I've seen. Let me read just a couple sentences from this. It talks about the historical basis of modern science being dependent on the assumption that the universe was made by a rational creator. An orderly universe makes perfect sense only if it were made by an orderly creator. It goes on to say that if atheism or polytheism is true, then there's no way to deduce from these belief systems that the universe is or should be orderly. I had never thought of it from that perspective, Don. Now, you're a trained biochemist. You're a trained scientist. Do they teach you about the history of science as you come up in the scientific disciplines?
No.
No.
Actually, you learn about some of the greats, of course, Sir Isaac Newton and, some of the other, Galileo and some of the other folks, but you don't ever learn about, the history of science having a Christian perspective or needing a Christian's perspective in order for it to flourish. Now, this article is talking about modern science as opposed to ancient science, but modern science. Of course, if what you're studying is going to change tomorrow, then what's the point of studying it? Because
you have to throw out all your notes and stuff.
It's going to be different tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the whole premise. But historically, the science really didn't flourish until man came with a Christian point of view that says there is a creator, and this creator is a orderly creator, and he didn't do things haphazardly, but he did it in order, and we can examine, the creation and get a better idea of what the creator is all about. I mean, that was the original motivation of science.
In other words, the original scientific thinkers, that is, users of this practitioners of the scientific method, were trying to find out how God made things work.
Exactly. And not only how he made them work, but he, from the point of view that we can study this at all, is the kind of a major breakthrough here that, the science that his creation can even be studied, whether you're looking at the stars and the planets and the rotations and how does all that work, or even delving, in things around us in the physics, for example. If you drop a ball or drop, something from a tower, then it's going to, come down to Earth. And it's not going to matter what the mass is. It's depends on some other parameter that, was the acceleration of gravity that Newton discovered. So, these things, you couldn't even conceive of a model if the universe was random.
Mm-hmm. Now, and what part of the article? Now, this is an article well worth reading by everybody out there. It'll stress you a little bit here in terms of just understanding what it is there, because they tackle so many huge topics in this thing. For example, the science of the Middle Ages. And that section of the article starts out by saying, while this period used to be called the Dark Ages, responsible historians recognize that it was far from dark. Rather, it was a period of great scientific advances stemming from the logical thought patterns of the medieval scholastic philosophers of the church. It maintains that it was the church that really harbored technical thought, that protected scientific development, persecuted what it would call heresy, of course, although it doesn't deal with the story of Galileo and why he was persecuted, but that could well have been political reasons and not so much scientific. But it says the church was really home base for the early scientists, and that the church protected that knowledge. And a lot of it came to fruition through the work of monks in abbeys scattered all across Europe, discovering this and that and what was made and what was not, and things like heavy plows and buttons and buttonholes and things that we just take for granted today, but were first developed during the so-called Dark Ages, which, it turns out, were not so dark.
Well, in that perspective, I mean, they were dark because because of the oppression of the people. That's the reason why they were a Dark Age, and not necessarily what was going on in the monasteries. It was almost as if the church was keeping this information to themselves, as they as a lot of the church back that time was keeping knowledge in the, science is the obviously the accumulation of knowledge, and to have that, to have knowledge and to acquire the knowledge, of course, it was the monks who could read, and they can read Latin.
I was thinking literacy would be a big part of this story.
Yeah, exactly. A driving force, as well as obviously their Christian beliefs that God did make an orderly universe. So while the Dark Ages were dark for other reasons, certainly within certain population, the educated population, which was the church at that time, things were moving along.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's another thought on the Dark Ages that I'd never heard of or never thought about before. But as life so many times happens, there is a confluence of one event happening in a vacuum and then another event happening in a vacuum, and all of a sudden the vacuums merge. I'm reading a book called Liberal Fascism. And yeah, it's a history of those folks who and we commonly refer to them as liberals or lefties now, who intend to overthrow things, revolt against things, damage things, destroy things, and is sometimes for a particular reason to get somebody elected, for a power grab, for whatever, but in some cases just because they don't like the way things are now. It's a kind of a recurring condition of young people, of youth. I mean, I remember when I was in my teens and 20s, I had no, oh, come on. People over 30, my folks, Are you kidding me? These people are running the place? Oh, come on. We got to turn things over. The Dark Ages in Wikipedia is defined as that period of time after the decline of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I'd never really thought about. The Roman Empire was the dominant cultural, political force of the time, and it declined. And now there was nothing left to kind of carry on with scientific endeavors and scientific discovery except for the church. And you know, those secular Romans would be, I'm talking in broad sweeping passages and brushstrokes now. But it seems like there would be a natural conflict between those two groups. And when one declines, obviously the historians would walk around and say, well, I guess we'll turn off the lights now. No, we're all done. And we were doing the important work. So these are the Dark Ages.
It's interesting you would bring up Wikipedia, because I went there last week to research some of this myself. These are some of the technological developments that occurred during the so-called Dark Ages. That is between about the 6th century and the 15th century. It's kind of the rough time just before the Renaissance. Renaissance was kind of the end of the Dark Ages, and then you get into the Age of Enlightenment and then the Scientific Age and Industrial Ages. But back in the Dark Ages, they were the first to develop, for example, the hourglass, and then the mechanical clock for measuring time. They invented wheelbarrows, useful. You got to think of how these people lived, too. Useful in construction, agriculture, and mining. A simple thing like a wheelbarrow could spur industrial development. The heavy plow, horseshoes, and the horse collar, the wine press, later to be adapted for use in the printing press, by the way. The same principles involved. Central heating, and the chimney, the blast furnace, the paper mill, the rolling mill for the production of sheet steel, glass mirrors. I mentioned buttons and buttonholes. They came to be during that time. The dry compass for navigation purposes, soap, cannons, the important refinements in gunpowder, and many, 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 many more, too numerous to mention. So it wasn't like the earth stood still, that knowledge was static during that time period. And a lot of that is to the credit of the church, and specifically to monks and nuns, for that matter, in monasteries, who were reading and writing and recording history and translating and also producing things and devising ways, tools, techniques for that production, including things like beer and wine and the things that some of the monasteries became famous for. So it's really a fascinating thing. It's not a dark age at all. And this article dates the Dark Ages between AD 500 and 1500. It says, popular opinion, journalistic cliche, and misinformed historians, notwithstanding recent research, has shown that the Middle Ages were a period of enormous advances in science, technology, and culture. The compass, paper printing, stirrups. Stirrups may have turned the tide against the Muslim invasion of Europe back under Charles Martel, back in about the, what was that, maybe 6th, 7th century? So,
My position is that the notion of the Dark Age, the notion that nothing happened here, was an intentional public relations attempt to make all of these things, no big deal.
Yeah.
It's nothing. Like, in fact, Petrarch was the guy who made the Dark Age noticeable. He wrote a book called The Cycle of Famous Men and Women. And I'm reading this off the Wikipedia page. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing this from memory. Okay. Full disclosure here. Yeah, I'm just not that bright, guys. You know, I know you were sitting there saying, wow, that Dave, he's really smart. Petrarch was the guy that conceived of the phrase the Dark Age, but he was referring to that period of time after the fall of Rome and all those wonderful, light, airy, wonderful explosive things that happened in the days of Rome, and that was the really enlightened period of time.
His perspective, when did he write that?
1450.
Okay.
And so in comparison, the period of time that followed in his view was not nearly as wonderful as the things that was going on in Rome. You know, I would like to know more about Petrarch and what was his... What was his axe to grind? What did he have going for himself?
The phrase I was thinking, yeah.
What kinds of things was he trying to sell? What kinds of things was Well, you know, was he a forerunner of Mussolini and Hitler, and let's overthrow all the good things that are happening now because, well, they were created by people over 30, and they can't be any good.
David, you're so political. It's amazing how you bridge that to real life. Don, there's another book that pertains here, and it they didn't reference it or anything, but there's a book called The Gifts of the Jews by Thomas Cahill, and it lays forward an idea or proposes an idea that really underlies this whole scheme of things, and that is that it was the intervention of God in man's timeline that changed the way mankind thought about time, that before that period, to go back to the ancient civilizations, the Akkadians and Sumerians and ancient Egyptians and so forth, everything was seen as being cyclical, and that man was at the total mercy of whatever deities there were, and it was the sun and the moon and the stars. Everything went round and round, the pattern repeated endlessly. If you were a farmer, you would always be a farmer, your children would be farmers, and nothing ever changed. But when God came to Abraham and made a promise, the whole way of looking at time changed, because now there was a beginning and a middle and an end, and time became linear, which made it, if you work that idea into this notion of the Bible as the roots of science, gave them the intellectual power and passion and desire to find out what was new and what was happening.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because it's the other aspect of that is when God told Abram at the time, get out of your father's land, and I'm going to take you to a new land. That gave Abram hope. And in the previous example that you, the cyclical feudalistic mindset, actually, which still exists, in the world today,
some cultures, yes,
obviously, in certain in many cultures, there is no hope. And so, you know, when God steps into the picture, He always gives us hope. And it was that hope that, well, there is a land, there is a promised land that I'm supposed to go to. Yes, it's tough leaving my family, leaving, what I know behind, but it sounds like this is going to be better. And I've got a purpose to my life. Mm-hmm. And that's what God does. And that's what the Bible does for us. Actually, it gives us hope.
And lays the foundation for what has become Western civilization, for better or worse. I mean, I'm not sure that we're still running with that same understanding. I think we've maybe lost sight of those origins. And this article over at creation.com also points out just a sweeping conclusion here that I never thought of, and it has to do with the Reformation, the scientific jump after the Reformation. Now, it maintains that during the years of the early church, that is after the initial growth of Christianity and home churches around the Eastern European and in Italy and in other places, that there was a long period, once the church hierarchy had formed, that church writers, that the so-called church fathers, the theologians of the time, kind of wandered from a literal understanding of what had become Scripture. Even before it was the Bible, there were these separate books that were respected and used in worship and so forth. But that over the next 1,000 years, theological writers wandered from the idea that the Bible could be interpreted literally. It was allegorical, like it was metaphorical, it was legend, it was folklore, it was symbolism, not so much literal interpretation. But this article maintains that it was the writings of Luther and his ilk that brought us back to a literal interpretation of the Bible, and thus reemphasized the order and the understandable nature of the information therein, and really fed scientific knowledge. Do you agree with that?
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's we would do good today to take a literal interpretation of the Bible, or at least a more literal interpretation, instead of saying that the first 11 books of the Bible are just fairy tales, that it's actually historically describing events that happened in the past. We would have a better understanding, for example, of the geology that we see around us, for sure, And even you know, even when I was in Russia talking about the Ice Age, one of the things that you know scientists get extremely wrong today is that of the ice core samples and the layers in the ice core samples and what caused them. You know, a reading of the literal translation of the Bible tells us that, gee, there was a great flood and the geology was turned upside down during the flood, and that the, you know, the flood, of course, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, but water covered the earth for almost a year. And what was happening during that time, and how did that, you know, affect not only geology, but the, you know, atmospheric conditions in the earth at that time. And of course, you know, that brought about the Ice Age, which then you can easily explain based on other things that were happening in the geological area with volcanic eruptions and everything, the laying down of the ice cores that we see today. So, you know, science would do good instead of shutting out any notion that we can learn anything from the Bible, because after all, it's only a spiritual book and it's there for only moral lessons. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is nonsense, and we should be. In a matter of fact, you know, the article points out that science flourished when there was a literal interpretation of the Bible. When folks started to sway from the literal interpretation, science kind of stumbled along and new discoveries weren't made because we didn't have the foundation that you know, something leading us and guiding us into, you know, the correct thinking, if you will, about how God put things together.
Well, that it is, that it forms the foundation, that the Bible and Christian thought forms the foundation for science, I think becomes more and more apparent. This article is just so good, so adept at pointing out why. They quote Stephen Snowbolin, who's the assistant professor of history of science and technology at the University of King's College in Halifax. Now, this has a bunch of big words in it, so forgive me, but I need to read this to you because the meaning is so key here. And I'll quote Stephen Snowbolin in this. Here is a final paradox. Recent work on early modern science has demonstrated a direct and positive relationship between the resurgence of the Hebraic literal exegesis of the Bible in the Protestant Reformation and the rise of the empirical method of modern science. I'm not referring to wooden literalism, but the sophisticated literal historical hermeneutics that Martin Luther and others, including Newton, championed. And he goes on to explain that it was scientists starting to study nature in the same way they studied the Bible, just as they studied what the Bible really said rather than imposed outside philosophies and traditions upon it, that they likewise studied how nature really did work rather than accept philosophical ideas about how it should work. Very clear statement.
Yes, it is. And that kind of sums it up. I mean, really, it's if you know, don't take a literal interpretation, but as I said, you know, impose your own interpretation on the Bible, you know, that's upside down. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it's there for. Obviously, the Bible is our guidebook to life, and life in many many meanings here, ultimate everlasting life. But even on a day-to-day basis, understanding the world around us, mm-hmm. Without a strong foundation, especially in the earlier books of the Bible, if you don't know where you came from, how do you know where you're going? Mm-hmm. And so that's, that was a very good summary.
And there's another part of the article, and I'm aggrieved here, Dr. Don, that they don't give you credit for your theory of devolution.
Well, that's because I didn't write it down.
Well, you've got to publish.
We'll make sure you get credit for it here. Belief in the fall of Adam and how it inspired science. Jump on that for us. What are they talking about with respect to Adam in the garden?
Oh, yes, Adam. You know, most, of course, the upside down science would have you believe that prehistoric man, antediluvian man, the man before the fall, before the flood, although they don't believe in the flood, but prehistoric man was stupid. And we didn't, you know, we're smarter today than
simpletons, primitive, yeah.
Yeah, primitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they were cavemen and all this stuff. Obviously, we know they were cavemen. But in fact, if you read Scripture and you understand what it's saying, Adam, for example, what was his first job? What was his first job in the garden?
Well, he had to name all the animals.
He had to name all the animals. And how long did it take him to name all the animals?
Well, there's a good question. I don't know.
Less than a day.
Hmm.
Less than a day.
Hmm.
So, because wow. Genesis 1 isn't separated from Genesis 2, and God did, there's many reasons for why he named the animals. One of them was to put a desire within him for his helpmate, which, of course, would be his wife, Eve, because he would, as he's naming the animals, he's seeing that they're coming in pairs, and these, you know, one is different than the other slightly. And so he's, after he gets finished this process, he says, you know, where's my helpmate? And so, you know, part of the process of naming was to give Adam obviously something to do, but in you know, more of a you know, practical term.
Well, also ascribe a certain authority.
The desire of the helpmate. So if he could name all of the animals, of which there were probably at that time well over 20,000 different kinds, in you know, in a day, he had to have extreme amount of mental capacity.
So he was the perfect man at that point.
He was the perfect man, mm-hmm. and he was to live forever. And so was Eve, who was supposed to live forever in the Garden of Eden, as I think we talked about before.
Well, I can see Adam in the process of naming all these animals. There's a number. Okay, that's 18,450. Okay, 18,451, step forward. You will be known as zebras. And then he looks up at God and says, who's going to clean up after all these animals? And God says, we'll get you a helper. And
there's a big,
I'm gonna dig myself a deep hole here, aren't I?
there's a juvenile book, and I don't remember when it was released, but I heard somebody talking about it the other day. But the history of poo.
And you're not talking about Winnie.
No, we're not talking about Winnie, and it's about the you know, the history of animals based on, you know, what they left behind.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be a fascinating book. But the point is that the life in the garden was different, and it may be what we're headed back to at the end of time in a great cycle. Of course, the last Adam, Jesus Christ, sacrificed to enable our sin to be imputed to him. There's a whole couple of paragraphs on this, too. It's worth a volume of books, but it's an amazing article. And we will link to it in the podcast for this conversation later today. It'll be at brokenroadradio.com. Under the podcast, just go to Don Clark's name there, and you'll see it. You can click on it and then find this article. But you can search for it, just Biblical Roots of Modern Science at creation.com. Don, we could spend weeks on this, couldn't we?
We could spend more time, because even the last comment with regard to Adam, I mean, I just scratched the surface.
Yeah.
I mean, what inspired, you know, scientists to, why would Adam even inspire scientists to do what they do, you mm-hmm. know? and that really wasn't answered yet, so.
Hmm. Well, they even quote.
Yeah, where did curiosity come from? I mean, Adam must have had curiosity, and eventually, you know, the people would look around at stuff around them and say, wonder why the bark grows on the outside.
Yeah. Well, and where did creativity come from? And where did, you know, the ability to make things come from? You know, if you read Genesis 1, it only takes reading Genesis 1. We know that that we are made in God's image. And so that makes us different from the animals. But it also tells us that we have abilities that the animals don't have. For example, creativity, artistic abilities, the ability to speak, the ability to put two thoughts together, to synthesize a new idea. You know, these things,
and to love one another.
And to love one another.
That's a huge
Absolutely.
One, in a very different way than the animals do. And Don, we kind of tackled this topic, that is, the theory of devolution, I guess it was last week we talked about some of the scientific research being done now to extend human life and how they think they're close to being able to do so by tweaking DNA and by actually several different methods that will one, slow down aging and maybe even reverse the process. And it was your thought then that the longer man lives, the more sinful he becomes. And he used Genesis to illustrate that too with the 120-year limit to the lifespan imposed by God. So we need to take that into account too, that we're getting worse day by day apparently, huh?
We are getting worse. And, you know, the Bible certainly talks about, Jesus talked about, for example, when the disciples asked him, and I think we talked about this last time, when the disciples asked him, when are you coming back, basically? And part of his answer was, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be when the Son of Man returns. Mm-hmm. And so, how was it in the days of Noah? Well, their thoughts were continuously evil. Man's thoughts were continuously evil. So I think, we can look at that, hear those words and say, that's very sobering because things are evil now, but are man's thoughts continuously evil? Now, some of us can certainly point to certain individuals and say, I don't think that person has a good thought in their mind, period.
and of course, Jesus talking to young Hebrew men who would have been well-versed in Scripture, including Genesis, they would have probably latched onto that instantly, the idea of evil. But when I read that initially, it was, Jesus is just saying life will go on as usual. People will be marrying and having children and going on, and this will all catch them by surprise. But to throw in the idea that the thoughts were continually evil, and again, the lifespan was much longer back then. God decided to limit man's lifespan to 120 years at that point. And your reasoning, I think, was just excellent in that, and that the longer we live, evil has a greater shot at us and takes us down the garden path, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. And... Yeah, because we start, it gives us more time not only to accept Jesus as Lord and Savior, but unfortunately, it gives us more time to reject him. And, of course, the more times that we reject him, the less likely we are to accept him in the end. Mm-hmm. So the result of that, of course, is we don't get better with time. Some say a fine wine, improves with age. Well, and I've read, because I haven't experienced it yet, that a super fine wine, does improve with age. But once you open that bottle, you have a very short period of time to drink it.
Mm-hmm. and it is less than 4.5% of all wine created will age.
Yeah, and it has the right ingredients, the right tannins in the balance that will cause it to age gracefully, as opposed ruining.
Yeah, one of the great fictions of the wine that comes out of northern France or middle France is that if you buy this by the case and it's brand new wine, we just made it last week. In 15 years, it's going to be wonderful, and we're going to charge you $40 a bottle.
And it's an
nobody
investment.
Knows that. You certainly don't know that from what you just tasted. Chances are it's got a better shot at it now than it maybe 100 years ago because of human categorization or tasting.
Certainly, but vineyards and wine teach us a great deal. In fact, it's used often in the New Testament to teach us about life in general, tending a vineyard and so forth. Jesus uses it frequently. And it's amazing how our conversations always kind of gravitate back to that, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems that way. Don, one final thing. Have you ever heard of the conflict theory?
Refresh.
It's a 19th century, proposition that there's always, that there's an intrinsic intellectual conflict between religion and science. And it was developed by a guy by the name of John William Draper. And there's a writer by the name of Andrew Dixon White. And they wrote some books and they wrote some articles and in the 1860s, 1870s, 1875s, that period of time right there. And, you know, they're suggesting that there is always going to be a conflict. Now, most, you know, the Wikipedia article also says that most serious scientists don't consider this anymore. But there's a lot of people that talk about it. And, I don't know why it's even has any credence, because it doesn't seem like it's lasted, you know, any longer than maybe 15, 20 years. But there are still scientists who believe that same kind of thing. And
well,
I'm curious.
Very much so. And yeah. if you go in the schools today and you say, well, I want to teach a class on creationism, you know, they'll laugh you right out the university instead of saying, well, yeah, come on. You know, we want to know, you know, how God created, you know, the universe in six literal days. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because that is the time period that Darwin lived. And of course, we know what his contribution to religion and science were. But you know, he was, you know, most people think that Charles Darwin was this amazing intellectual giant, but he just leaned on his predecessor, just kind of capitalized on you know, his predecessor in writing his book, The Origins of Species. You know, and the subtitle, which is something to do with the selective races. So his book is really racist. It's not a, which, you know, obviously you don't hear. you don't hear about because, oh, that would be offensive. Well, his book was offensive. And it was not only offensive to the church, but it was offensive to most people at the time.
Well, I'd Stephen, like to go ahead, Dave.
I was doing a quick search on Darwin's predecessors, because I've read the guy's name too, but I couldn't think of it.
Charles Lyell was his
Lyell, yeah.
And the work of his father was instrumental too, wasn't it?
His father was a pastor.
Yeah. Well, Charles Darwin was a Christian.
He was raised that way, it is a big debate whether or not he accepted the Lord in his final deathbed, but. It's questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we won't know until we get to heaven. But
yeah, there's mm-hmm. I want to close this way, because again, we can pick up this topic again next week. We'll see what develops. Although we've got some other questions for you, Dr. Don, that we're dying to ask here. But this article over at creation.com kind of sums up this way: some atheopaths, which are kind of counter-religionist people who don't believe, not necessarily atheists, but atheopaths, that is, against a God, admit that science was in effect a child of Christianity, but now claim that it's time science grew up and cut the apron strings. However, none other than former UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher answered that type of claim, and this is a Margaret Thatcher quote. I think back to many discussions in my early life when we all agreed that if you try to take the fruits of Christianity without its roots, the fruits will wither. And they will not come again unless you nurture the roots.
Mm.
And we'll kind of leave you with that thought, and we'll maybe pick up on that thread next Monday when, again, Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Dr. Don with creationmoments.com. I'd like to urge you to visit their website, creationmoments.com. Now, you can link to them from ours at brokenroadradio.com. You'll discover that they have a wealth of products and services and information for you, for your churches and your small groups and Bible studies and the like. It's an awfully good place to visit, creationmoments.com. And again, this podcast, our conversation, will contain a link to this article. If you'd like to go read it later, I certainly recommend it to you. I think you'll find it fascinating. Don, as always, it's been a delight. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun as usual.
And even David got to take part today. We didn't like David.
Let me talk.
Yeah. Steve Bell continues the music on A Broken Road Radio Monday.